Welcome to FinTech Family Hour, folks. This is Zach Anderson Pettis, U.S. Content Director at Money 2020 by day, your host by night. FinTech Family Hour is now on YouTube. Please go check it out. Subscribe. Check it out. Subscribe. You know, do that everywhere. Follow, like, interact. We love it. Our guest this week is Cameron Ansari, an operator, individual investor, and partner at Headline Ventures. We covered private markets, public markets, and so much more. He's convinced Stripe isn't going public in 2024 and has many other hot takes that we kind of debated about, kind of just talked about, but it was fascinating and a wide-ranging conversation. This episode is brought to you by Skipify. Go to skipify.com to learn more. Without further ado, here's Cameron. Cameron, hello, my friend. How are you?
Hi, good.
Good. Good to have you here. So before we jump into topics, IPOs, the world of fintech, all this insanity, let's talk a little bit about your background. So creeping on your LinkedIn and all that is basically like making me very jealous of what your Carta account probably looks like.
Ah, yes.
Just going through all those private investor kind of moments. So give us like, you know, not the maybe whole thing, but a good portion of your story. How'd you get to where you are? How'd you become a VC? All that.
Sure. Look, I don't think anyone, you know, grows up and tells their elementary school teacher that they want to be a VC when they grow up. Probably not even sure that they know what that means or what that is. So I don't want to say you end up as a VC, like as if, you know, it's some awful thing. But like, I think later in your life, you kind of like, oh, that's something that'd be cool to do. But I, spent the past 20 years in tech, both as an operator and an investor. And I think it's actually been valuable, like yourself, to actually have been on the other side and been, you know, in offices like this and open desks and no pretense with, you know, crummy snacks and whatever. Those snacks are beautiful. Thank you. But, you know, to have lived kind of that frugal startup lifestyle, and I've done that now three times, which is useful. And I started as a VC originally in Silicon Valley in 2007, like very different era. I mean, we can talk a lot about that if you like, but it was like cottage industry almost then, which is hard to believe. But we were in the same parking lot as Sequoia and a bunch of other firms. And back then, those firms did not have growth funds. And I was at a firm that was called, at the time, it was called Lehman Brothers Venture Partners. For those of you who don't know, Lehman Brothers Venture Partners no longer exists. Yeah.
Say more, please.
It's an old brand, but the firm rebranded to Tenaya and it still exists and it has done well. But
did it rebrand in 08?
It did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So I'm reading between the lines correctly here. Okay.
All right. It was a rebrand. We swapped out Lehman and the LP stack for HarborVest and some other folks.
I didn't even know they were in the venture. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, like everybody that's in that world is going to end up quasi in the venture world in some way.
They were, I mean, they'd been in the venture business for, you know, 10 plus years. So this was the funds I joined were Lehman Brothers Venture Partners, Fund 4, and then Fund 5. So these were pretty advanced even at that point.
Wow. And those were growth funds.
They were like venture growth. So they were Series B and C. And this is the point I was going to get to, which is like back then, none of the venture firms had a growth side. So Sequoia would walk across the parking lot, literally, and be like, here are companies raising Series B.
So this is how we got markups.
This was happening like 2006, 2007. Yeah, it was old school. Walk across the parking lot, 3000 Sand Hill, and the partner would tell the partner I was working with, you know, here are Series A companies raising Series B and C. Are any interesting? And you kind of like, you know, like sell their wares and you kind of pick and choose. And sometimes you have to take like the dog to get the jewel, you know. But that was kind of the deal flow that we had. And at that time, the only other firm doing that was really, it was this firm, Lehman Venture Partners, which became Tenaya. There was a firm called DAG, D-A-G, that was doing it. There was a firm, Granite Global Ventures, which became GGV, that was kind of doing it. But eventually, all those firms like Sequoia, Excel, began their own growth funds. So they no longer had to rely on other firms to do the B's and C's. But that was the business back then. So that's how we started. Spent a couple years there doing that. And then joined one of the companies that we tried to invest in called My Yearbook. It was a social network for teenagers.
I was going to say, I feel like I just have a hunch as to what direction this might be going.
Yeah. Well, My Yearbook was kind of like a Facebook for high schools. That business we ended up selling and taking public in a transaction at the end of 2011. And that's when I joined Graycroft in New York. So I was at Graycroft in one form or another for better part of 10 plus years and did a lot of our early fintech work. Back then, it wasn't even called fintech. I think it was called just payments or whatever. So, you know, first day in the door, I ended up kind of taking over the Venmo deal, which we had done as kind of a seed at that point and became the board observer there.
What did taking over the Venmo deal at that? Because Venmo's had
a storied and like bonkers history, right? Yeah. Like at one point it was like a frat house, and then it became like a, you know, buttoned up, and then it was a frat house, and then it was buttoned up, and then it's back and forth, and it's all over the place, and like how do we get to where we are, kind of thing.
I was there in the frat house days, so this was you know, it wasn't quite a frat house, but I was
hoping for.
It was a really kind of pretty, I don't know, you know, to be I would say junky office, but like very just bare bones, like wood floors. Mm-hmm. The boardroom was just like literally like it felt like plywood, and it was like an unfinished room.
Bezos would have been proud, basically, is what you're saying. He liked that.
But we were in the third and fourth floors, and I think the second floor was literally a, you know, to use a generous term, a massage parlor.
That's a generous term, then I don't want to know the other term.
Yeah, you don't know the other term, exactly. So it was that kind of a place. You know, the office, you know, the rent was cheap.
So that's how they found product market fit, was massage parlor the payments, whole time. Yeah. It all makes sense now.
That's when you mark on the Venmo, you go private. You know, you don't want to post.
Yeah,
that
that's when they invented the private feature. Yeah. Was they went to the second floor. Anyway, keep going.
That was the spot. So, you know, but meaning like we had done the deal, but at that time it was a very small company.
Like how small at that point?
20-ish employees. And the user base was very small. We're talking like 25,000, 50,000 MAU kind of thing.
And were you like coming in as a quasi, because I don't even know if I can call you an adult at this point, but like quasi adult to try and like, or were you helping them figure out MTLs? Like what were we doing?
So at that, so they had hired at that point, the two founders, Andrew and Ikram, were there. And then they hired Mike Vaughn to come in and kind of be, you know, he was really the adult, and right. He was doing the MTL. So he was the one every board meeting would go through, like, here are the states, state by state. Here's where we have the license. Here's where we're at in that process. Ikram and Andrew are much more in like product and tech and growth. And then they had, you know, a handful of other people, really talented, awesome engineering team. And I actually have a photo from one of the board meetings we had there. We went to the roof afterwards, and then like a team photo. And you look at that photo, and like all those guys have gone on to do great things at other fintechs.
I mean, it seems like there's a lot of overlap with that, right? Like, we always talk about the PayPal mafia, but you could probably say the same of a Venmo mafia. You could say the same of, I mean, so on and so forth. It seems like the serial entrepreneur, or the I learned a thing, holy shit, this industry's wildly broken, I'm going to go double down on trying to make it slightly less broken in a different way, seems...
Right.
I mean, it's kind of hard not to. It's such an infuriating industry that it's a natural tendency to want to go fix shit if you have anything inside of you that's entrepreneurial, I guess.
And that team was super entrepreneurial, and it was heavy, like very heavy engineering oriented. Both Andrew Cortina and Ikram were engineers. The business had started actually inside of, or had affiliations with, this other company that was doing, I think it was called I'm in Like With You or something. It was like a dating thing that had some overlap, I think, with the old OMG Pop and like Gaming World and Dan Porter and that universe. So they were like engineers there.
Terrible name.
Yeah. And then if I recall correctly, the Venmo idea originally came around because they were at like a bar or restaurant, and they wanted to buy or pay for like a vending machine, like a jukebox. So it was like had a music angle to like paying for songs effectively.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, and Ikram can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's where the original.
We'll wait for the from. Yeah, we'll wait for the fact check, but I like it.
Yeah. Anyways, so at that time, yeah, super small company, 20-25 people, definitely less than 100,000 users. And it was unclear if it was going to be a hit or not. I mean, it was just like the product's great, team's great, but like it had not caught on in a viral way outside of just like, small pools of people. But that was great to like kind of dig in with those guys. And then, you know, ended up doing a bunch of other deals there, mostly in fintech and e-com. We ended up selling Venmo to Braintree. There was an opportunity at that point to come back into Braintree as a separate deal, which I did, and then went from there. So did a lot of fintech and e-com there, did the seed deal and Bread Finance, did Asimo, Recurly, and then
it just keeps going. I mean, like the list is
just,
like,
you know, once you do a few, then you know activity begets activity.
Yeah. So when like Venmo is an example, or any of the others, how much? And I guess every VC will have a certain answer to this in a certain direction, but how much are you spending time inside of the company, right? Working with the founders, working with the executive team, whatever it is. And how much are you, writing a check, observing during board meetings, and, having a large portfolio?
So, I mean, it's evolved over time.
How that's changed.
Yeah. I mean, when I was, kind of full time at Graycroft, I had, let's say 5 or 10 portfolio companies I was responsible for. Originally, when I started, it was really just Venmo and a few others. So I had, a lot more bandwidth. And with Venmo in particular, at that time, they actually did need a lot of kind of help. So I was there with them working on, at that time, we were talking about like App Store ranking and how to get the app like further.
Growth hacking, how I miss you.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, back then, again, it was sort of, you know, there were things you could do. Like if you dropped a new version of the app, if within the first hour or two, you had everyone in like all the investors and their friends and everyone who worked at like Excel and any like all the firms that were involved. If everyone updated the app and wrote a review within the first hour or two, the Apple algorithms would pick that up. And, you know, so we knew these little hacks like that. And I was working with them on that because we had done that at my prior company, My Yearbook, and we kind of knew how that worked. So I was helping them with some of that, helping them with fundraising, putting the pitch deck together as we're kind of going back out. And then eventually, you know, Excel did a lot of the heavy lifting here, I'll be honest, with the deal with Braintree. But we had other buyers in the mix at that time, too, that, you know, did not work out. I think at one point they were talking to Facebook, in fact. That would have been interesting.
That would have been a different world today.
It would have been a different world. But, you know, honestly, let's just assume like someone like that had bought it. I'm not sure if the app and the team would have survived. I think the marriage of Venmo and Braintree had a unique symbiosis that was singular because like the Braintree team had a lot of kind of great business acumen, a strong business model and revenue, B2B. Venmo fully consumer at that time did not have really a revenue model that was making a ton of money. So it was still burning cash. So having the two kind of balance each other out really worked well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot. It's a very Cash Appy, Square-y kind of, or block, sorry, relationship sort of thing. It makes a lot of sense.
And so the two companies really helped each other. And then, of course, the whole thing got bought by PayPal within a short amount of time. And, you know, the rest is history.
What was the most formative kind of in your years of operating? I mean, I know you were corporate development at Pinterest at one point, right?
Yeah.
That was probably a very interesting
gig.
That
was the most intense thing I think I've ever done, venture or otherwise. I think the most intense.
How long were you there for? How long was that?
I was there for a few years. So I joined at the end of 14 and I left in 17 and was still kind of advising them until 2018. But it was hyper intense, involved a ton of travel. I was based in New York, going to SF all the time.
Yeah.
And we were really active during that period. And it was the period of hyper growth for the company where it was like, when I joined, it's a, you know, a couple hundred people, one building. We still have like all hands on Fridays. To when I was leaving, it was like a couple thousand, you know, seven, eight different buildings. Yeah. And
what was your remit? How much of it was go acquire and how much of it was think about an off-ramp, just knowing your background?
So very little of it was about that, the latter part. At that time, there was no real thought of. I mean,
so it was an actual corporate development job. It wasn't corporate development. It wasn't like a think about selling the company under the guise of corporate development. Okay, cool. Cool. I mean, you never know, you know? Yeah.
It was really because they had done a handful of smaller deals and they'd had people kind of moonlighting in the role for like 6 months or a year. Like Sarah Tavel did it for a while and she's great. Mike Yamartino, who now runs Route, he did it. Mike Yang, who was actually ended up being my boss, he was the guy that kind of started the group and did it. And he used to be at Google under Drummond. So like there were all these great people that had done it for 6, 9, 12 months. But then they were like, okay, we want to finally like have someone who's like in the seat, full-time, dedicated.
Yeah.
So that's when I came in and we were hyperactive. We were the most active amongst private companies tied with, I think, Uber and Dropbox. I think we each did like 9 or 10 deals in those
years. I did not know that at all. What did those acquisitions look like? And did it have anything to do with your fintech like knowledge or like payments knowledge?
I'm trying to think of any of them. A couple of them had like checkout aspects to them, but there were more. It was a variety of stuff around commerce, search, discovery, AI. A couple of them were like design and content oriented. And it was, a lot of them were for the teams, right? It was like, we didn't keep a lot of the products except for one where we bought Instapaper, the...
That one I remember. That's why I'm so curious about it. And like, when you said that you're one of the most active, like, I don't think of Pinterest, you know, like layering on a whole bunch of Legos on top of it.
Small.
Like it was, so it was really, it was a talent acquisition thing more than anything else.
And, but you know, at that time, like Yahoo was doing these deals where they would buy, you know, just like 10 engineers, right? Like, we want 10 mobile devs. It's an acquihire. This wasn't that. This was more like, hey, we really want to get, you know, senior person X in the building. They will never apply for a role. They'll never apply to our LinkedIn, you know, messages. They have a company. So if we could like, maybe pick up their company, grab a few of their folks, and then get that person plus, you know, one other to run engineering or, product for a certain area. So that was the idea. So I was called it wasn't acquihire. It was like, you know, CEQA hire or execu hire. Like, you really wanted like someone that you thought could be that kind of level talent in the building.
How, well, I guess my brain goes a couple directions with that one. One, how did that shift your thinking, or did it shift your thinking about like the importance of people and the intensity of like a recruiting system or something like that? I mean, it it seems like that makes so much sense, but I actually have never heard of that as a strategy. And
that was a big part of our strategy was just like, you know, and Ben, the CEO, would come to me. He did come to me at one point and ask, I mean, hopefully he won't be upset about this, but he was like, you know, I think every company in the Valley wanted him. Brett Taylor, right? Like, what do you think it would take to get Brett Taylor? And Brett Taylor was running Quip at the time. And I told Ben, I was like, look.
Actually, for the audience, will you explain who Brett Taylor is?
Brett Taylor
is like singular, there's some inside, you know, baseball here happening. We should probably define.
Yeah, I think he was the CTO at Facebook.
Yeah.
And I think even then he had come into Facebook, I believe, through a company he'd founded and they had bought.
So he's running quite a strategy. Yeah, he's like, well, I'm not taking your salary. I'm starting a company. You buy my equity and then give me a salary.
He's an entrepreneur at heart, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what makes him singular is because, you know, what we wanted to do, and I think what Facebook and others want to do is, as you get bigger, you can get stale. And so you always want to refresh that entrepreneurial DNA.
Yeah.
And bring people in who are frugal, scrappy, move fast. They don't have this kind of like, let's put together 10 slide decks before we do anything. And those are founders. Mm-hmm. So you want to bring those great founders into the building continuously to like push the rest of the org. And he's, you know, he's singular. And so he had sold, I think the company was like Friendfeed or something, to Facebook. He was CTO there. And then he left to start Quip, which was the like kind of like a Google Docs type, Notion type app. And, you know, everyone knew kind of he was probably the most kind of coveted person that you could possibly get in the Valley. And I told Ben, I was like, look, I think it's going to be really tough. Like, I think you have to probably, you know, and I threw some number out there that I thought was like wildly exorbitant. And Ben would, you know, be like, oh my God. And he was kind of like, you know, sort of nod. I mean, Ben's a very thoughtful person. And he was like, okay, you know, we kind of dropped it. And then literally, I think the next, before we had a chance to even have like the next conversation about it, the next like week or two, Salesforce bought them. I think $900 million or something.
Mm-hmm. What was the number? Do you remember the number you threw to Ben?
The number I estimated to Ben was something like a third to a half of what what Salesforce ended up buying it for.
Wow. Okay.
So I was off, but I wasn't like wildly off, but still I was off by a lot.
I mean, in the Valley, that's just like squint and it's basically, you know.
But so then, I think it was like 850-900. And then of course, Brett then became a major part of their org for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years, eventually becoming, I think, like co-CEO or co-COO of the business.
I didn't know he really moved to the business side that much.
Oh, yeah.
I knew he was really high up.
I think he was running Slack for a time. And then he was like the co-CEO. And then I think he just left in the last year. And, you know, he's doing something else, I believe. But yeah, so he, you know, that kind of a person, he's obviously the epitome of it. But there are many others like that. I mean, one of the companies we bought was Highlight, run by Paul Davison, mm-hmm. who ended up starting Clubhouse afterwards. But, you know, to get him in the building, like he was such a unique talent and we wanted to get him in the door and have him work on stuff for Pinterest.
How much of that like unique talent comes from the lore of them and how much of it comes from the actual them in your experience?
So you have to see the actual them in practice, right? Yeah. Like in action to be like, okay, yeah, that guy's really good.
It seems like it would be not all, well, it would be difficult and it would be very difficult, but in the ways that we make 20 million or more in the world, like the idea of building up your lore,
yeah,
like this seems like a strategy for the right kind of grifter.
So, you know, right, for the right kind of grifter, yeah, if you want to just be one of these people who like, but for the people that are legitimate and Paul is extraordinary and there are others like him in the building, I think what set them apart, and you would see it right away when they came in, was it's a combination of things. One is if they've been in the space for a while, they have a following. Mm-hmm. And so they're like a recruiting magnet. Like people follow them on Twitter. People follow them on, back then it wasn't Discord. It was more like, what's the place where you keep your like code repositories?
GitHub.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, he's got like 10,000 GitHub followers.
Yeah. I guess the existence of GitHub kind of answers my question, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a Twitter for, you know, coders, right? Yeah. It's like people have tons of followers. So those kinds of folks, you could just like, because again, like the hardest thing to do in these companies oftentimes is recruiting. Mm-hmm. Especially for like really like 10x engineers and PMs. Right. And these people were magnets for those because they had worked with those people. They were in those networks. So that's one, is they're awesome at recruiting. Two is they were great at just ideation. Like Paul had so many ideas for the product that were, I think, really terrific. They could present really well. Like Paul could get up in front of a room and tell you, like, you know, I think the best people that I've seen in the tech business are ones who are technical and know how that works, but can also communicate it.
Yeah, speak some version of English.
Yeah.
Translate.
That combination is rare, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was a really inspiring, good manager. Like, he was someone that people wanted to work with and for. And, it, like, having the combination of all that stuff is pretty rare.
Yeah, that's a true unicorn of a human. That's wildly rare.
So I think that's why those are the folks we were kind of targeting.
So how long were you there again?
So it was a few years, you know, like I said, from like kind of end of 14 to 17 or so.
When did the IPO?
The IPO was April of 2019.
Okay.
So, I mean, when I was there, it was always kind of in the back of people's minds. I remember being in like conference rooms like this and seeing the stack of S1s in the corner for like Twitter and Facebook and, like, you know, those that had come before us. And so obviously the finance team was, you know, had that in the back of their mind and we were starting to kind of look at that stuff. But yeah, it was really all about growth that time and just kind of bringing people in the building. And the one thing that we did not do that, you know, I think I always wish we had done is, if you think about the way that Google and Facebook built their businesses, and let's not get cute, they're ad tech companies. Like, they make their money on advertising technology.
They take all of the VC dollars that you guys plow into the companies. Yes.
Yeah. And they show ads to humans, and humans pay for those ads, and that's what pays the bills. And then they have all their cool stuff that, you know, you can message people and search and do stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, and people, because people are always like, oh, I hate ad tech. Like, as investors, I'm like, ad tech's like the corner of like the internet economy. So Google bought DoubleClick, AdMeld, a number of companies that underlies a lot of their ad tech. Facebook similarly bought, I think, Atlas and a bunch of companies that have worked with them on building out their ad tech. And so at Pinterest, we were like, well, we can either build everything from scratch or buy some assets. A lot of the best assets at that time were already purchased. So it wasn't like there was that much left out there. But we did look at a few things that I thought would have accelerated the business significantly. And we never ended up pulling the trigger on one of those. And so it meant, I think, that Pinterest had to really spend from like 2017, 18 until just the last couple of years building the entire stack from scratch. And a couple, you know, sometimes like doing it over again to try to get to like some level of parity with the bigger platform. So I think that was one area where, we could have probably accelerated things if we bought something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're telling any secrets, right? Like the idea that Pinterest was an amazing product that needed to figure out how to monetize through shopping or what advertisement or whatever you want to call it. But like there needed to be a payment that happened on the site or some kind of like, you know, click through to something that's going to create revenue. Like that has always been the elephant in the room at the end of the day. It makes total sense. This episode of FinTech Family Hour is brought to you by Skipify. You'll get to hear much more about Skipify in the coming months here on FinTech Family Hour and why they've caught the attention of some of the smartest leaders in payments. Their CEO, Rith Martin, will be joining us on our next episode. Not this one, but wait a week. Here he comes, live from New York FinTech Week. I promise you that one is a treat and one of the more unique episodes I've ever done. Standing out on a pier, stretching, trying to make sure our backs don't hurt. It was a good time. But if you're not familiar with Skipify, it's a next generation digital wallet that connects financial institutions with merchants and shoppers at the moment of purchase for the first time, allowing for a friction-free shopping experience for cardholders wherever they shop. Skipify's connected wallet, integrated at the merchant level, is used by banks to customize the shopper journey with points offers, merchant rewards, and alternative payment methods. With Skipify, banks are able to increase their share of wallet and authorize up to 99%, hold on, my voice can get higher, 99% of transactions without any increase in fraud. You heard that right, folks. With financial institution partners like Amex, Synchrony, and most recently, Visa, this fintech is well on its way to checkout domination. That's right, I said it. To learn more and get personalized demo of Skipify's connected wallet, go to skipify.com. So I want to transition actually to, we're kind of talking private markets, public markets. The wonderful Libby that's sitting in the corner for listeners and watchers. Now you know Libby's in the room and why, if you are watching, I keep looking at the corner of the room. sent over a couple things that you have been thinking about writing and just kind of like top of mind for you recently.
Okay, yeah.
And one of them is Stripe will not IPO in 2024. You didn't even put a period at the end of the sentence. You said period, and then you said period, period.
Oh, so, did I do that? Maybe. Yeah,
Stripe will not IPO in 2024. Period, using the word period.
Oh, period, the word. Okay, yeah. I wanted
the extra no, emphasis. It was not a typo. All, it was just yeah, it was extra emphasis.
Yeah.
So unpack that for me, yeah. Because I think a lot of people in the world are very convinced that's going to happen before the end of the year.
So it's a few things. One is that, you know, they raised two back-to-back rounds of capital, right? They did one last year, which was largely not a fundraising event. It was like for their tax offset for their...
Yeah, that was such an interesting thing for everybody. Like the pontification around that was hilarious. And then we all came around full circle and we were like, oh, it didn't matter. Okay, keep going. Well, like, or I mean, it mattered, but...
And I mean, a very generous thing to do, right?
For
them to retain employees and make sure that they didn't have some massive tax overhang.
Yeah. Like you say generous, and then it's like to maintain employees and avoid taxes. But yes, they can go together.
Right.
They can go together.
I think it goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
So, you know, so they did that, and then did most recently another round, which was more of a fundraising event and actually helped with getting some early folks liquidity, but also getting more capital for the business. So I think from a cash position, they're relatively okay. I don't think there's like some burning need to raise cash.
Right.
I mean, an IPO, it basically does three things. One is, raises cash. Two is it's a marketing and publicity event. Like, hey, here we are. It's like a coming out party, like quinceañera, whatever.
Yeah.
They don't need that. Everyone's heard of Stripe. They don't need the cash.
I love the idea of an IPO being a quinceañera.
I mean, it's a big, like,
who? No, I'm with you. It's just hilarious.
The one that IPO, I mean, Reddit, we heard of, but like Astera Labs, like, I never heard of Astera Lab, whatever.
It's so funny.
All of a sudden.
Yeah. I've gotten to know the NYSE team recently and like we filmed a video there last week, and just like being on the floor there is the most fascinating thing. Cause you just realize like capitalism is fucking broad. Like the amount of companies out there and the amount of unsexiness that exists and like their creativity around trying to make it. There was like some, I think it was like an oil company or something like that. And they had a very like Texan name and the guy was getting interviewed on the floor and he just had a cowboy, like he does not wear a cowboy hat. He was in a suit, but he put a cowboy hat on to try and like turn it into this thing.
Yeah, you got to brand so it. Yeah,
it makes sense. Yeah.
But the truth is though, at the same time, there are only like 5,000 public companies in America. Like it's crazy how few there are relative to like the millions of SMBs and startups. So to get to that moment is extremely unique. And it is a ton of exposure. Like all of a sudden, all these hedge funds, CNBC, Bloomberg, everybody like all of a sudden now knows the name Astera Labs or whatever that Texan like company that you saw.
I think it was called Lasso something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's like, and then what do you do, Lasso? It's like, oh, actually, let me tell you what we do. Yeah. So, it's a marketing event. It's a fundraising event. It's a liquidity event for early employees and investors. And importantly, and this is something I thought a lot about at Pinterest, which made my time a little difficult, was when you're private, it's using stock for transactions can be very tricky because you're doing this whole, you know, song and dance route. Well, what's your stock worth? Well, the last 401A was this, like our last private round with Andreessen was this. Like, whereas if you're public, that stock trades every day, every minute, everyone knows exactly what it's worth.
Yep.
So if I'm offering you stock for your startup or your company or your employees, you know exactly what, and so that's a huge benefit. You have currency to spend for talent and for acquisition. So those are the four reasons to do it. They don't need the cash right now. They don't need the marketing. The liquidity, I think they just had some happen with his last fundraise. The currency could be interesting for M&A and paying people. But like, again, so I think there's no urgency. So that's the broader thing. And then two, they have all these business lines they're trying to grow into.
Yeah.
Their processing business is a blockbuster. There's no question about it. But they want to add, you know, card issuing, more like B2B payments. They want to add potentially, I think they have a working capital product they're trying to add, or they have added subscription billing. There's all these like other things they're trying to get into. And none of the other things have really like caught on in the same way as processing.
So is your theory basically that one or two of those needs to catch on and then the multiple is just going to be even more bonkers? Is that kind of the thought?
I think they want to wait until... You know, and not have the scrutiny because like, once you're public, then like it's just the stock can be hugely volatile. If you miss a quarter on your card issuing product, everyone's like, oh, Stripe's card issuing product isn't working.
And card issuance / banking as a service / embedded finance, whatever the hell you want to call it, is it's an interesting time
that
and the policy
really,
and regulation there.
Yeah, super volatile right now. So I think they want to have one or two of those other things kind of grow into something more stable so they can say, look, we're not just a processing business, we also have these other business lines that are doing really well.
Yeah. So what's your prognostication around, like, I guess the broader fintech market, right? I think as people talk about IPOs that are likely impending, like Plaid and Stripe are the two that I think people just name over and over and over again.
Chime.
Yeah. Sure. That one I'm super skeptical of. What do you think is, let's go to the first question. What do you think of the broader thing? And then let's get into Chime, because as interchange shifts and a lot of other things happen, I'm so curious how the hell that's going to go.
Yeah. So in terms of fintech IPOs, I'm trying to think of the last big one that came out, because we had for a while, I mean, it was like
Reddit because of the GameStop thing. No, I got nothing.
Well, it was like, well, Affirm came out and Marqeta, and there were a handful of names that came out kind of one after the other. Upstart, the lending one for student loans.
All those were a couple years ago?
Yeah, a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And then some of the SPACs like MoneyLion and NerdWallet, or not NerdWallet. Actually, maybe NerdWallet came out too.
You're invested in Better, right?
Better came out back last year. So a handful of names have come out, but there hasn't been like a big blockbuster IPO in the fintech space. Maybe Affirm was the biggest one in the last few years.
I feel like it's the one that's probably gone the best with the best brand and has like the most respect and longevity associated with it. Yeah.
It's done well. I mean, but that had a rough time too. If you follow the stock, it was like up and then down. And then, and then, you know, at the same time, we had sold my company Bread Finance to Alliance Data, and that's had a similar thing, but now it's kind of stabilized. So I think that it hasn't been like an arms open market for fintech companies to go public. So I think we're in a bit of a waiting period until like the first one of any note comes out. And I think that might actually be, you know, we have to look across the pond to maybe Klarna. Klarna could be first.
Where do you think they would list?
I'm guessing that they'd probably list, I think they'd probably list in New York and then maybe cross list in the Swedish exchange or whatever, somewhere else or London.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I don't, that's why I'm like, I don't see that being a LSE brand. Like,
I think it's
either NASDAX or New York Stock Exchange.
It's a US
right?
listing. Yeah. And then they do like this, the thing where you double list.
However that works. I don't totally understand that works, honestly.
Yeah. That's for your next
it's a different
podcast.
Yeah. Somebody
else, that question.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Revolut, I hear, is further behind because Revolut's still got some stuff to figure out.
Well, that kind of brings us to the Chime thing, right?
And it's
like,
the Chime thing.
Yeah. So it's like, you got Revolut, you got Chime, you got some of these like the neobanks that have made it out of infancy and into anything serious, but still don't have charters, right? Like at the end of the day. And, or at least, well, I guess Revolut does even in the US. And
their own bank charter, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you think that? How do you think the neobank world is going to function going private to public? And also, what do you think about the neobank world in general? Like, do you think that there's going to be a new set of upstarts? Because it seems like everybody's very anti, like, well, we don't want to do anything a consumer. We don't want to do anything that, like, Chime already did that kind of a thing. But it also kind of feels at the same time like maybe it's time for a resurrection of neobank. Maybe it's actually a good time to lean into it. I don't know.
Okay, so there's a lot there. So one thing,
answer all of the questions. Yeah. Forget none.
I want to come back to you. One thing I will say is that in the venture career, I've noticed that the times where everyone has a consensus that like a certain sector is bad,
it's the best time to start it.
The best time to invest or start.
Yeah.
So like consumer fintech is bad right now. Like it's like out of favor. Yeah. Also, by the way, ad tech, D2C e-commerce, like you know, it used to be crypto. Crypto's kind of back a little bit. But like, you know, lending, everyone's always hated lending. But
what are you
like,
saying? This is cyclical?
Well, I just think like, and that's like, but again, like, let's not get cute. Like Affirm lends, like Upstart lends, like Visa and MasterCard are kind of lenders. Like, you know, so let's not.
Lending is associated with the best and largest outcomes associated with finance. And if you can't figure it out, it's really hard to be at a high multiple at the very least. Like you can go public, whatever. And this is my biggest thing about Chime. And it's like how much of their revenue is based on interchange and the ability for like, you know, we saw the recent settlement with in terms of like interchange being decreased at certain places and capped. And like you look across the pond at the way that interchange works there and like actually regulated interchange. And like, could that come? I mean, I think we have enough lobbying power that we won't get to that point, but like, is that scary in the long term? Like just depending on that one?
I mean, is, you know, are regulators coming for the sort of the extra fat around interchange that all these companies have been collecting? But at the same time, like, you know, these companies, Visa, MasterCard, Stripe, Braintree, like, you know, they've invested real dollars in CapEx and infrastructure.
Yeah.
And, you know, compliance, fraud maintenance, KYC, all these things are not trivial. So there is a ton of value they're adding. So you have to compensate them for that value. So I don't think you're going to, in the U.S., see interchange get depleted much more. I mean, it's already at 2.9 is kind of the cap or whatever the average is. So I think that'll stay relatively stable. What is happening is the merchants passing that on to the consumer. I've seen that happening more and more, where it's like transparency. Hey, if you pay with a card, I'm going to tack on a 3% fee, which was not happening,
right,
you know, a few years ago.
I guess the larger question is the revenue mix diverse enough and strong enough for a Chime? And we're picking on Chime, but like really any of these neobanks, right? Like they're adding on credit building, they're adding on some things along those lines, and like small dollar loans. But at this point, you know, I'm unaware of any of the super consumer oriented ones we're talking about doing mortgage or anything like that, right? Like they might have like a deal with Better or whatever it is, but like for them to actually vertically integrate and monetize that in a way to be a long-term public company, like, are you nervous about that idea? I guess I'm just trying to understand.
If you think about it, like if you think about traditional banks like B of A and Chase, I mean, they're not really like, I mean, they make some money at interchange, but you're right. I mean, the majority of their money is off like the lending and the yields on the assets under management and all that. So it's an AUM play. And the neobanks don't have that. So it's a lot of it. I mean, they have some of that, but really it's about these other fees, convenience fees, annual fee. They have overdraft fees, which a lot of them don't, because that's been like their thing.
That's the thing, is like they've gotten rid of all of like the classical fees around the periphery.
Yeah.
And if they bring them back, they feel like a payday lender. They feel like a, you know, or that's an extreme, but like it doesn't
jive with the audience.
And the flightiness of that kind of consumer, I think, would be a lot higher than the flightiness of a consumer at JPM.
Well, so here's, I mean, so back to the issue at hand, like the only neobank ever that has had a meaningful exit was Bank Simple in like 2011.
To the OGs.
Yeah.
Back to the OGs.
You know, for $187 million or something to BBVA. But since then, if you can name a neobank in the US or Europe that has had a meaningful exit, I'd love to hear it.
And you just said $180 million, and think about the amount of fucking venture dollars that have been plowed into B2C. Right. Like
Everyone's like, waiting to see, like, because if Chime comes out, then, you know, you start to validate the model a little bit. Monzo raised a huge round recently, which I was, you know, I don't want to say surprised, but like, I was like, oh, okay.
I just have issues with all of them, because like, and then you get into Monzo's great and I like the company a lot, but you think about the total addressable market in terms of their current geographic mix.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not a huge. You know,
they're in Europe only, and
they're not even in every part of Europe. I don't think like that's, it's hard, like, to do. Mostly the UK.
Yeah.
And then they've expanded through different portions. I think they're in Germany, whatever. But like, you know, Revolut has a bigger footprint. Monzo is probably a better business, but they all have like these struggles around the periphery. And I also wonder, like, so much of consumer neobanking was built around the idea of like improving a consumer's life.
Right.
And I'm so curious if we're going to lose that North Star as we move closer and closer and closer to IPO.
I mean, let's not kid around. The incumbents have caught up. Like, my Citibank app is like pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not like, oh my God, my Citibank app is terrible. Like, I'm missing all these features. Like, no, it's pretty much got most. So now you're really talking about like audience, right? Like, time. It's for an audience that maybe doesn't want to have a Citibank app or a JP app. They want to, it's their first account. Maybe they're younger, you know, they don't meet the minimums to create like a checking account somewhere else or whatever. So that's totally valid and a great thing. And so I think at a certain point, the company gets valued on the stickiness of the user base. Because if you assume they can retain the users and not churn them, you can continue to monetize a banking relationship over many years with additional products, upsells, you know, fees for different things. As people go through events in their life, they're buying a home, they're having a baby, they're doing a wedding. Like, those are the moments you want to be with them. You offer a credit card product or whatever. Yeah. Like, so I think that can be the real value. And Chime's done a great job, I think, of attracting, you know, millions of accounts.
And seemingly keeping them. I think we all have questions about what a active account definition is and this and that and the other. But it seems like they've done a really good job of not churning a crazy amount or anything.
And then the B2B neobanks, that's also super interesting, because that's a whole different ballgame. But Mercury obviously you know, really came out hot last year with the SVB stuff and took a bunch of accounts and has grown tremendously well. But you also have, you know, Roe here in New York and Relay, which is based in Canada, but has mostly U.S. clients. Novo, you know, a handful of others.
Right.
And then you have Brex and Ramp, which are kind of like B2B banking-ish, but more around like spend management and card.
Yeah.
So they're kind of their own like unique animal as well.
It's going to be interesting to see how it develops.
I think Chime and Klarna come out first. I think both those companies probably list in the next 6 months is my guess.
With some of the numbers I've seen coming out of Klarna, I feel like that if they come out first, that could be a really, really, really good thing for the industry, it seems like.
Yeah.
And like, I'm more nervous about the idea of Chime coming out first a little bit.
I mean, Chime is a wild card. Anything could happen. It could, you know, catch fire. It could also get crushed, like the way that, you know, Dave and some of these other, you know, consumer neobanks have happened.
I've had, Vishal. I was blanking on his name for a minute, but I've had Vishal on the podcast a couple times from Better.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've always had a interesting time, him and I. What did you think of that SPAC? And like, what do you kind of think about the future of Better?
So I think Vishal is, you know, again, he's singular.
No one has ever not paused after that, by the way. Vishal is...
I really like him, and I think he's aggressive. You know, he doesn't mince words.
Yeah.
He built a monster of a business from like zero to where it got to. And even like the scaled back version is still like a pretty meaningful business, you know, a larger business than I've ever built or most of us are ever going to build. And I think what that company does today is they're essentially in some ways waiting for the interest rates to come back in line. And so it's like, look, we have cash in the bank. We're going to hang out and maintain the current business we have. And when, you know, the sun comes out, we're going to make hay. Like that's.
As in you. So I've heard a couple different versions of it. Like one being that, you know, the technology underlying Better, that they will sell that to other institutions and that will become the biggest part of the business.
Similar to like what Blend does.
Or... Yeah, sort of thing. I was not expecting you to really say that. Because the idea of them getting really deep back into origination or even into refi, depending on kind of what's going on, like that's an interesting perspective.
I mean, it's down the line for sure. It's not happening tomorrow.
Yeah, but it's also one of those things that is cyclical.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, if you're skating to where the puck's going to be, and if that software business is actually growing at a solid clip, which to be candid, since interviewing him in Vegas, I haven't totally kept up, but I know the software is good enough. I'm sure it's generally growing.
Yeah.
And if you have this thing in your back pocket that's like, yeah, and we have all of the licenses and everything else associated to, you know, really hit the gas when it's time to hit the gas, it's actually really interesting.
I mean, that was the origination refi was obviously what.
Yeah, that's what grew them initially. Yeah, right.
Had the massive growth the last few years. That, you know, hit a wall once the rates went up. So now I think you can diversify the business by adding these other things. I think they've had other products like HELOC and other things that they're working on. And I think they bought a UK business as well to kind of supplement some of the stuff they're doing.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So I think he wants to be able to see if they can offer maybe mortgage there or do other things there. So I think there's other growth vectors for them while they kind of ride out this cycle. Now, if you're really looking down the line, then it's like, okay, well, let's just say the interest rates come back and they're lower. And all of a sudden, they're demolishing it again with like a ton of mortgage origination, you know. But that itself is cyclical. So it's like, how do you make this like not just a 2-3 year play, but like a 5-10-20 year play?
Yeah,
and that's where I think you have to diversify into the other areas.
Yeah, it seems like it's such a fascinating thing to me. One of the things that I asked him, I interviewed him in Vegas at Money 2020 on stage, and one of the things I can't remember how I phrased it, but I called him an asshole. And I was basically like something along the lines like you're fintech's like favorite person to hate. Like everyone loves to hate you generally.
Oh yeah, there's been a whole meme around him. Yeah, people like think he's a jerk. Yeah,
yeah, and he's just wildly unique. I don't even know if I have a question out of this. It's more just like that individual and the idea that founders are gonna be always nice, loving, tender, cuddly bears is just like it. Like, I want that to be true. Like, I wish everybody, like Zach Perret from Plaid, like, says 3 words a day, and they're the most meaningful words you've ever heard in your life.
Right.
And he's just like a lover, you know?
Yeah, but, he's
like,
great.
But I don't see him, like, cutting your throat in a back alley in some of the times that you have to, right? And I think he is capable of that. And I think he puts himself around people that are capable of that. And Zach balances himself out well. But that's the most interesting part about, like, the cultural dynamic for me is, like, he's almost like mortgages Elon or something like that, where like he's built this big business. He's got a hell of a future, but the perception of him is so
right as being tough and aggressive. And like, I mean, some of the best tech founders are not cuddly bears. Like Steve Jobs was not like a warm and fuzzy guy.
Well, yeah, once you've passed on, it's easier to write a different version of history. But no, there was no version of him that was really cuddly.
Not really, you know. And so, I've worked with all kinds of founders. I've worked with founders who are much sort of more genteel and low key, and others who are a lot more aggressive and like have a lot more bravado. I think there's a place for each of them. Yeah. It depends on the company and the culture, and if it jives with the company and the people they've hired, and those people are still motivated to work for like even someone who's aggressive and someone who's like super quiet. I think there's a place for that, right? It's like being an extrovert or introvert. Like society is a place for you.
Yeah. I feel like Vishal is like a wartime CEO that like it becomes peace and he's like, no, we will fucking make war. Yeah. Like war will happen. But anyway,
that may be true. But again, I admire his aggressive. I think at the end of the day, I'd rather have someone who's aggressive than someone who's passive.
100%. Yeah. If you're writing a check into the company. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is, it is war.
Yeah. And it's not fucking easy as a thing that I think sometimes we forget. So one of the other things that you sent across, and it's not really like a specific question, but it was just like some thoughts about the Discover deal / Capital One Discover in general.
Well, I forgot about that.
I mean, honestly,
is that still happening?
I'm not going to say I forgot about it, but like kind of forgot about it.
Right.
I'm with you. What do you think is going to happen there?
So I do think it's going to get approved from a regulatory perspective. I think it's a super smart deal. I think Discover is this kind of a little bit under the radar, like crown jewel asset, because they have, a network that is not as robust as Visa and MasterCard, but like still exists, is strong. Like, you go on any restaurant around here, you're likely to see a Discover logo, like that sticker in the window.
Yeah.
It's kind of legacy. It's just been there and no one's really done much with it, right?
Like, yeah.
So that's, and so if you combine that with Capital One's sales, marketing, customer acquisition, merchant acquisition, like their heft that they have.
And culture, I would think.
Yeah, and culture.
If you can pull any of it together.
Because Capital One's, itself is a very kind of aggressive, entrepreneurial, marketing-oriented place. They're hyper-growth-oriented. And so I think it can help kind of Discover kind of wake up a little bit, because I think Discover's been a little sleepy. There's also this really hidden jewel asset people forget with Discover, which is the Diners Club. The Diners Club card was kind of like this prestige brand, back in the day.
Yeah, how long that was? When was that? Early 2000s? That was like, when was the heyday? 90s?
I think, Diners Club was like 80s and
90s. 80s and 90s.
It was kind of sunset in the US. But my understanding is internationally, you can still use Diners Club cards.
I did not know that.
I believe in some, but I think that it may not be Discover. I mean, it's like license it out to other folks. But I have to double check that. But I know they've had an ambition to relaunch Diners Club in the US, which I think is a big opportunity to create kind of a prestige.
That's super
brand. Interesting. Yeah.
And almost like compete with Amex kind
exactly.
of vibe.
Compete with Amex as like a, more affluent lifestyle, going out like glamour, restaurants and going out to shows and concerts and travel and, having all the rewards and stuff. And I think Diners Club used to have like a booklet with like all their prestige restaurants and ratings and stuff. So I think that's a big opportunity for them too, to bring that brand back.
That's fast. That's almost like a Michelin star kind of play, the tire company getting into food kind of thing. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And, it's obviously a major spend category for credit cards. So I think Discover's got a lot there. And then the reason why I think it probably is not going to get blocked is because it actually creates a formidable competitor to Visa and MasterCard by giving Discover more heft, as opposed to like always being this kind of like smaller third or fourth player behind those two and Amex.
Yeah, you would think that it would disrupt the duopoly in a like pretty significant way.
New, a new kind of potential sheriff in town. He's got a little more deeper pockets.
Yeah. And the vertical integration associated with like what a Capital One already has and had layering in that infrastructure there makes it a very, very interesting and confusing competitor for Visa and MasterCard in so many ways.
Yeah, because it's going to have the bank, which Visa and MasterCard don't have.
Right. And the customer acquisition function and the this and the everything that goes along with it. Like, it's a business, not a infrastructure.
It's going to be a really unique, I think people were saying it's kind of like it'll be a hybrid between like what Visa and MasterCard have, what JP Morgan has. And it's kind of it'll be a unique entity. And I think it will be you know, hopefully a force for good, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so the force for good thing is really interesting, right? Because like the anger of like an Elizabeth Warren or whoever about this and like the idea of, you know, well, you're just going to make two financial, you're combining two financial giants and it's just going to be even stronger bigger, yeah. And then too big to fail becomes even more too big to fail. And like, I find that to be such a, my politics has gotten very interesting as I've gotten older and I've gotten more into finance because I grew up very much like all the way left, like full on, like not even a idea of conservatism when it comes to, you know, just even finance, like none of it. And now getting into the industry, understanding everything that comes along with it, you listen to Elizabeth Warren say something like that and you're like, well, but do you understand the dynamic of who they're competing against? And actually, this could be a positive thing for a consumer and a merchant and everyone. This could be really good. Have you thought about that? Or are you just mad about finance?
Or you're just mad about like, it's like a one size fits all where it's like, oh, two companies that are medium sized creating one mega company is a bad thing. Like that's like a meme. Well, but you have to look at the circumstances, the facts, like the underlying economics of like this industry.
And what's happened with like if you're going to do something in that realm and block that, like look at what's happened. I mean, this is totally separate, but look at what happened with JPM post COVID or during COVID, like and then with SVB and like JPM is, in my opinion, separating themselves from that pack in a pretty wild way.
Yeah.
In a, like, it's just JPM, but it's turning into like a Visa and MasterCard running away from Discover. It feels like you said, like the Citi app is great. Citi's doing awesome. But I think throughout most of my experience in fintech, we've always said JPM and Citi. Right. And then we kind of like talk about B of A, we talk about the others, but we say JPM and Citi for the most part.
Right.
And it seems like JPM has run way faster recently there.
Yeah.
And the idea that isn't a risk for society, but the idea of combining Discover and Capital One is, I don't know. I mean, I run an event.
Like in Canada, there's only five banks, apparently.
Right.
And they own 99% of the market.
And the same is true in LATAM. I mean, not five, but, you know, that's like the number of, it's now that Money 2020 is expanding into Asia and like, you know, so I'm getting a much more holistic worldview of this whole thing. And you realize like, we're just weird as shit. Like the idea that we have 5,000 banks, the idea that we have, or 4,000, whatever, this is very strange. It's wildly out of the ordinary. And it's
hyper-regulated. And, and we're issuing no new charters. You have to like buy an existing charter in order to make it. It's like, you know, it's hyper like constrained. And yet it's like, you have all these kind of, I don't know, they're ghost banks, but like all these banks that have charters, but aren't really like very active.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole, the chartering system in general is just,
there needs to be some cleanup there.
Yeah, but it's just like, how do you, I don't envy the job of whoever it is that has to clean that up.
Or I mean, and would it be harmful to, let's say like each year allow for like 10, 50 new charters, like whatever it is?
I mean, they're chartering new de novos. It's just not not many of them, right?
Is that how Lead did it? Did they?
No, Lead was existing. It was like family run bank owned by the Roland family, and then Jackie and a list of very impressive individuals came in and did that in my backyard, which is so weird.
Yeah, they're
in KC. It's so freaking bizarre that like maybe the most interesting and exciting, from my perspective, community bank in the United States is there, and like, you know, three or four sponsor banks. It's an interesting little city in its own way when it comes to that.
It's up and coming.
But Super Bowls help.
But so Leeds, and then Column, the one that...
So Column was another one that was bought. Pretty much all of the like tech first, well, that's what I call them, is tech first attempts at banks at the very least. Grasshopper was... I think Grasshopper was de novo.
That might have been one of the only ones de novo.
Grasshopper was de novo. What's the other one that's run by Colin Walsh? Vero. Was de novo, too. They did that whole charter. But then you go to that conversation and you're like, was that even a good idea? Like, looking at the way that Vero's grown or not, and the amount of money and compliance burden that they've taken on through that charter, like, it's fucking hard to... Like, I was at MBKC, a community bank in Kansas City, before I, like, got into tech world... Bond was, anyway, whatever. We won't go into that. Longtime listeners know what that sigh was. Where was I going with this? NBKC. So it was, Where was I going with this? My anger about Bond sidetracked me.
The cost and regulatory. Was it worth
so
it?
So one of the things that my CEO like helped, I was like, how do you start a bank? Like, what does that actually encompass? Yeah. Right. Like, and it's a question that you would think that everybody in our space would know the answer to. But in my experience, like nobody but community bankers really, or in regulators, have a really real sense of what that looks like, because you can't start a new JPM. Really. I mean, you got to start it down here. And it's like the amount of money you have to raise to open the doors to just take deposits. You can't lend. You can't, like, it's like, you know, $30, $40 million for a de novo bank to open the doors.
You have the balance sheet.
You just have the balance sheet, hire some people, whatever. You know, you spend a couple million on CapEx. The rest is literally just the balance sheet. And then at that point, like, your balance sheet isn't even strong enough to lend. You can only take in deposits. You just got to go out in the community and be like, oh, this billionaire. Okay, finally, we can now do a $1,000 loan like 10 years later. It's the difficulty of it is understated to a wild degree. Yeah. And I feel like it's what slowed Vero down more than anything. So, and that brings me back to the Chime thing, where I'm like, I'm talking out of one side of my mouth about Chime functioning too much on interchange and the other side of my mouth about Vero moving too slow because of the bank charter. But like, I don't know, it's just interesting.
You gotta, I mean, in some ways you gotta pick one or the other. I mean, it'd be nice to have both. But yeah, I mean, you think this is why, like, in the simplest terms, like, you know, we talk about fintech, but fintech really is, it's the fundamental, like, fintech component, the base block layer of fintech is the bank. So it's like some organization entity that, you know, takes money in and gives money out, like whether it be lending, payments, like, so that's it, like brass tacks. So everything else is all like things around the edges here, but like that is the core unit.
Yeah. Like, do you have net interest margin or not? Right. Like, that's the question at the end of the day.
You know, but again, like, but banks have multiple ways to make money. So yeah. I think it's okay if someone is a neobank and has a more asset light model and doesn't need all these branches and whatever to generate revenue from just, you know, some maybe some small interest amount, but like really it's like fees and interchange and other things.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it develops. And I think we're coming right up on time. So tell us a little bit about, like, you know, how to find you, the day job, what you're investing in day to day. Like, you know, now that we're at the end of it, let's talk about you.
So, yes, I have a new film coming out. Thank you.
Right, exactly. Plug everything.
So I invest full time, day in and day out, do pre-seed and seed kind of on my own. I have a small vehicle I run. And then anything later, Series A, B, and beyond. I'm a venture partner now with Headline. It used to be called eVentures. They were our old kind of sister fund at Graycroft for many years. So worked with those guys for a long time. Did a bunch of deals together, like Asimo, like Recurly. And we've been hyperactive, both at Headline and on my own, the last kind of 6-12 months. B2B payments, tax. I love the tax space.
Consumer or business or both?
Anything. I mean, taxes is such a massive, complicated, like Byzantine area.
Yeah, you can blame Kansas City for that too. It's that. So, do you know that background of like H&R Block?
No, I can blame Citibank for this.
You can blame H&R Block for this. So, basically, what happened was it used to be that you could, you know, like the government just knows how much you make and like you didn't have to file taxes, right? Like it would just happen. And then there was a regulation that was created and was significantly lobbied for by H&R Block to basically create the idea that a tax return needed to be created, the taxes need to be filed, like that whole side of the, like, it doesn't need to exist. It just exists because of a good amount of lobbying and like some really creative entrepreneurs. And now H&R Block's like nothing like it was, but
the whole system is crazy. It's like,
it's nuts.
You're supposed to like know all these rules and come up with your own, you know, self-reported, massive, like complicated math formula for like what you owe the government, send it to them, and then have them decide whether it's right or not. And then if it's wrong, then you get penalized. It's like the whole thing is crazy. And, you know, once you get into like business taxes and things like, you know, equity compensation, I mean, these things get really...
My life is confusing as shit with the day job plus like Skipify sponsoring this and, you know, FSF. And like, it's always very interesting tax season. Yeah, thank you, Skipify. Come tax season, it's always like, it's just the worst part of the year. Yeah. I'm just filing an extension this time because I'm like, too fucking busy and over it.
Oh, extensions, that's the way to go. Because, you know, you don't even get half the documents in time if you have like...
Exactly.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So tax other...
Is, I think B2B payments is a major opportunity. Tax is a major opportunity. Increasingly obvious as the world in BaaS and others is getting complicated. Everything around like fraud, compliance, KYC, KYB. that space, I think, has a ton of opportunity. So those are all exciting sectors in fintech. I'm also, you know, I get spicy. I still do e-commerce. Like,
you crazy guy.
Listen, one of my best performing companies right now is a direct-to-consumer e-commerce business.
What is it?
I'll give him a shout out. I don't know if he won't, but it's a company called Poncho Outdoors. They make men's fishing shirts. They sell them on Instagram or, you know, other outlets, TikTok, and they sell them direct to consumer on their own site. But that business is crushing it.
There's something really, if you can figure out that advertising algorithm and you can get your CAC low enough, like the, you know, and you have the right niche product and
big
yeah.
market. I mean, you know, I remember when the founder, Clayton, was incredible. He was telling me like how big the market is for fishing shirts. I was like, fishing shirts, incredible,
sexy stuff.
Yeah, unbelievable. He's like, if you been to like Clemson or Auburn, and like every single person there is wearing a fishing shirt.
I guess that's true.
It's not just for fishing. It's like,
yeah, no, that's
the
like
point he made to me is like, are you wearing North Face right now? He's like, I was like, yeah. He's like, do you climb glaciers? I was like, no.
It's like the new Vineyard Vines is wearing a fishing shirt.
Like, wow, it doesn't mean they're fishing today. It's just the shirt. So, and then now he's got Western shirts and a bunch of other stuff. But like, yeah.
Now I just, and our next episode will be Cameron's Closet.
I mean, I only have two or three of the fishing shirts because I'm still figuring out sort of, you know, my
what do you wear them with?
My brand. Yeah. Like, what do I pair it
I'm going
to
do a fishing shirt and a blazer today.
And plus, like, you know, because they have the buttons and stuff, it can be a little heavy. Like, it's got metal clasps.
Yeah. Is the price for fashion.
You can't wear one, by the way. I think if you like a pacemaker, so you got to be careful.
That is a good disclaimer.
The magnetic.
Most spot. People that listen to my podcast have heart issues, so that's a good.
Just so you know, just put that out there. don't want us to get sued.
Yeah,
but yeah. So look, e-commerce is still, I think, a big opportunity area, both like commerce tech as well as actual people that make and sell stuff.
Yeah, I love it, Cameron. Thank you, my friend.
All right, thank
this
you.
It's been a blast. This we'll do awesome. It. We'll do it again in like a year. We'll catch up.
Cool.
Love it.
Thanks for listening. If you're still listening, you're probably reaching for your phone to pick your next podcast or switch to music or just call it a day because you can't believe how much valuable information you just took in. But before you pick that next thing, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, and all that jazz. Generally scream from the rafters about how much you love FinTech Family Hour. Thank you again to our sponsor, FS Vector. And until next time, stay healthy, keep your head high, your costs low, and I love you all.